All right, our first sponsor today is Retrofret Vintage Guitars. By now, I hope you've checked out Retrofret's site and Instagram feed. And if you are in New York City, I hope you've made the trek out to Retrofret. I know it's a bit of a haul from Manhattan, but it is so worth it. They have a great team, and it's a pretty overwhelming place to be in the best way possible. Now, on to the fun stuff. They just got a 1956 Dan Electro U2 in jade green available, as well as a blonde 1966 Telecaster, and my favorite guitar they have right now, a 1937 D'Angelico XL. That's a 17-inch body. This guitar was owned and played by radio personality Eddie Wilson, who was known as the Vagabond Drifter. I love guitars that have a bit of a provenance behind them, and this one has it in spades. Anyhow, go to retrofret.com to see what they have in store. They're always adding to their inventory, and I should add they do great repair and restoration work, so definitely hit them up if you have any needs on that front. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Verlini, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal. Before we get started, I know we have a lot of listeners and readers down in Texas, and specifically the greater Houston area. We're thinking of you. I hope you guys are all safe and okay. I hope guitars are nice and dry. If you want to send me any stories, feel free, jason@fretboardjournal.com. I'd love to hear how you guys are all doing. I also want to thank everybody who wrote in about the epic two-part Zach Vex interview that we just did. That was a ton of fun. I'm glad you guys enjoyed it. I try to mix this podcast up. I try not to be too repetitive in terms of when we talk to musicians or luthiers. I never intended to do two pedal guys in a row. But here we are. It's Labor Day weekend. I got to do it. Today I'm interviewing Chris Young of Union Tube and Transistor. He is from Vancouver, British Columbia. You may have met him at the Fretboard Summit. He is a great friend of mine. I've known him for several years now. His pedals are incredible. Long overdue interview. I'm glad we were finally able to do it. Chris is always up to interesting stuff. He's collaborated with Jack White before. We talk about that. I know a lot of guitarists love his Moore boost pedal. We have one here at the office, which we love. And he's just released a new model, the Lab pedal, which is a rather unique compressor. We talk a lot about it, but I didn't feel like that was still enough. So we did something kind of interesting. We took Chris and the Lab pedal down the street to Johnny Singster's Crackle and Pop Studios and shot a little video of it in action. So this episode actually has a video companion piece. If you go to fretboardjournal.com and click on the podcast episode page, you will see it there. I think it's also on YouTube. And you will at least be able to hear what this thing does. Chris is a great guy. He runs a great business. He also runs a guitar store up in Vancouver called Exile. He's not so great on doing the demo videos. And you know what? We're not so great on doing demo videos either, but at least we did it. So it's the thought that counts. I hope you like it. We're not going to start doing demo videos all day long now. Don't worry. Others do it. We're going to focus on the magazine. But I wanted to get this out the door. We've also wrapped up our 40th issue of the Fretboard Journal. We're proofing it right now. It's going to go to the printer next week. Hopefully get into everyone's mailbox by the end of this month. If you haven't joined us yet, go to fretboardjournal.com and subscribe. What are you waiting for? Use the coupon code PODCAST. I will take $5 off your order. We are a reader-supported company. Every subscription really matters to us. If you've ever called us with an issue about your subscription or needed to place one, you know 9 times out of 10 you're going to get me or Scott answering the phone. We are a tiny operation, so every subscriber really matters to us. And we have some incredible stuff brewing over the next couple issues that I would love to be able to share with you. Also, we're talking still about that electric standalone issue of the Fretboard Journal, and you guys had some great feedback. A couple of you had some great stories. We're crunching numbers. I think we're going to be able to make it happen in 2018, and you guys will be the first to know if that actually becomes a reality. Also on our site right now, a brand new video from a brand new trio called Dear Lemon Trees. Every week we try to put out a new video on fretboardjournal.com, so if you haven't been there in a while, head on over there, bookmark it, make it part of your weekly rotation. Take a break from Facebook and all the political sites and all that other good stuff you're looking at. Dear Lemon Trees were great, great harmonies. We absolutely loved discovering them, and I think you guys will dig them. Last plug of the podcast before we get to the interview. If you've looked on YouTube for guitar lessons, you know that there's some good free stuff out there, but you got to wade for it. You might have to watch 8 minutes of a 10-minute long video before you decide that the guy's a bozo or there's nothing to learn there. But if you've discovered Guitar Tips, Adam Levy's weekly video series. You know you found one of the most valuable channels around. He's got technical workouts, philosophical insights, gear advice, and more, and he really knows what he's talking about. Adam has been featured with Norah Jones, Roseanne Cash, Alan Toussaint, Joe Henry. He has been featured in our magazine. He has written some of my absolute favorite stories, including cover stories, in the Fretboard Journal. He's an incredible talent. He recently rebooted his Guitar Tips channel and has taken it to a whole new level. It is still a weekly video series. It has professional grade inspiration for players of all levels, but now he's offering PDFs and high quality MP3s of his musical examples, secret playlists of the music he's been listening to, guest tips, transcriptions, and other cool content. He's calling it Guitar Tips Pro. And the best part of all is you can access it for as little as $5 or $10 a month. That is a fraction of what it would cost to study with a private instructor of Adam's caliber, and more than half off what most online video instructions cost you, the ones that you pay for. If you're ready to go pro, visit guitartipspro.com and sign up today. I just did it. It is done via the Patreon website, so it's pretty damn slick and easy to do. Check it out. All right. As I said, this is our conversation with Chris Young of Union Tube and Transistor. He hails from Vancouver, British Columbia, up in Canada. And unlike the other 150-plus podcasts we've done for the Fretboard Journal, this one has a video component. So if you want to learn a little bit more about what we're talking about, head on over to fretboardjournal.com. Click on the episode page for this podcast, and you can hear all about it. Thanks so much, everybody. Keep the feedback coming. Please keep posting reviews on iTunes. They are helping us out with our search ranking. We continue to be amazed at how this podcast keeps growing. And if you guys ever have any podcast ideas or stories, or you want to be interviewed or what, you know where to find me, jason@fretboardjournal.com. How's it going, Chris?
I'm very well. Very well. Yourself?
Doing great. Thanks for visiting us. Thanks for visiting Seattle.
Always love coming down.
So, I've known you for a long while. I've known about Union for a long while, but I don't know much about your pre-Union days. I know you were a musician in Canada.
One of my first jobs out of high school was just at a record store. I mean,
yeah,
not on like a tower, but there was this chain in Canada called A&A Records.
Okay.
And I just thought it was the bee's knees. The working at a record store was just, to me, fantastic. And I was there for, I don't know, maybe 2 years. And it went into receivership. We showed up one day and the guy's just like, give me your keys. You're done. I was like, oh, that's terrible. And the guy, this buddy of mine, well, he's now a buddy, but at the time, this guy who was my manager called me and just said, what are you going to do now? And I said, I'm going to find another job like that one. That was fantastic.
For 2 days.
And he was like, you're never going to have another job like that. Like, that's just never going to be part of your reality. And I was like, what? You can't tell me that I've peaked at, you know, 19 or whatever it was. And sure enough, I mean, it was, yeah, I didn't find anything like that. I think I applied at every music store and video store in the Lower Mainland trying to get something and just didn't get anything. And I probably went to work for Starbucks and did that for a number of years. But then I got hired. I was touring that whole time. So I would, there was this band from Calgary called Huevos Rancheros.
Yeah.
Who I was a huge, huge fan of, and just started haranguing them saying, hey, you should take, you know, somebody on the road to sell shirts with you. And they're like, we're doing just fine. And after about 2 years of me bugging them, they went, fine. We're doing a West Coast tour, you know, Vancouver to San Diego and back. No money. Do you want to come? And I was like, yeah, let's go.
Sounds like you.
So, yeah, I was like, of course, that's what I want to do. And I had a blast. I had a fantastic time. I met some amazing people who are still friends. And I came home, and I think they gave me like $50 in the end, and I got records from every band.
Nice of them, sort of.
Oh, yeah, they didn't have to give me that.
Where were you sleeping?
Oh, couches. It was like couches. There might have been one or two hotels in like a 2 week stint, but there was this one house affectionately referred to as Couchopolis in LA, with these, at the time, kids who were booking, UCLA, and they'd been given this, it was quite great. They were given some, like, I don't know, $20,000 budget or $50,000 budget. And what most people would do at UCL was just put one big blowout show.
Yeah.
They just booked a ton of small shows instead.
Okay.
And so Huevos played in the cafeteria at UCLA with Fu Manchu, I think.
Okay.
And it was fantastic, but there couldn't have been seven people there.
Yeah.
Like, besides the bands and the kids booking it. But they let us stay at their house for, like, on and off for, like, almost a week, maybe. So, like, we'd do a show and then come back. Like, you know, if it was within a two-hour drive, we wouldn't get a hotel. We would just go back to their place and crash. And there was, I think it was a two-bedroom place, and there was five of them living there. And then they were letting four of us stay there as well. All
right.
So it was just sleeping bags on the floor and them introducing me to The Simpsons and that kind of stuff. But, yeah, I had a really good time. And then that band, I worked with them for on and off for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of, you know, started off selling T-shirts and then T-shirts and driving and collect the money. And by the end of it, I was essentially their road manager. And those guys are still friends to this day.
Yeah.
I've stayed in touch. They're all Calgary guys and really good dudes. And
you're playing guitar at this point?
No, I hadn't even. I think after a couple of years being on the road with them, I was like, I should get a guitar.
Really? All right.
Yeah, like, yeah. I don't think I even. My dad had maybe when I was younger. He taught me, you know, how to play Satisfaction on an acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
Which was wholly unsatisfying. And then my parents gave me an electric guitar, but I think they didn't think I was gelling with it, so they gave it back to the person who they'd borrowed it from.
Okay.
And then probably with some Starbucks dividends from, like, because I got in there just when the stock options were
okay.
A thing. I took some of that and bought my first electric guitar. And I was never great, but I was like, I was kind of consistent and I was like steadfast. I was going to get myself in a band and
yeah,
ended up joining a few bands in the 90s, I guess. No one, actually one of them played outside of BC. We played one show in Edmonton. Somehow we got convinced to play a Food Not Bombs benefit in Edmonton, which all was right. Insane because two bands with like no gear loaded in a station wagon and drove out there and played this show. And I remembered like it was like the first and last time that I ever played a show with a borrowed guitar. And I was like, never again, never
yeah.
again. It's not my guitar. I'm not playing the show. Like yeah. this is, it was some locking that Floyd Rose thing, which I think solidified my hatred of those so bad. And I left. Another band ended up hiring me to guitar tech for them.
Okay.
A band called Copyright, who were out of the ashes of this fantastic band called Slow, who were just there after 30 years, their record's finally getting re-released, and it's a punk rock Canadian classic, so everyone who's listening to this should go out and buy a copy of Slow's Against the Glass release.
It's out now?
It's pre-orders now. I think it'll be okay. out soon. So, yeah, they hired me as a tech.
So you're tinkering with guitars, if you're a guitar tech on a...
Yeah, no, by that point, that's probably... Yeah, you know, I've been playing a couple years, and I think, I've lived in some cheap, shitty apartment, and I didn't have any real-world commitment, so I think every payday I would go out and buy, like, a $50 or $100 guitar pedal.
Okay.
Just like some cheap pedals. Like, I kind of like, I can't afford guitars and I can't afford amps, but I can afford pedals.
Yeah.
So I just sort of buy up pedals and, but I had like weird rules for myself at the time. Like they couldn't be big pedals. So like no big EHX pedals. They had to be MXR Boss or sort of DOD size.
Okay.
There's sort of these strict rules.
Was that an aesthetic thing, or did it fit on a pedal board? Or
I think it was, yeah. Like, I had one of those plastic molded Boss carrying case pedal boards, and I was
sure.
like, so it had to fit in those. That
okay.
was sort of my, like, if it can work on this, then it works, and if it doesn't work on this, it's
yeah.
no good.
Yeah.
Which, our stuff wouldn't work on that, so I'd be screwed now.
You would be.
So, yeah, I toured with them. Their first tour I did with Copyright, I did, like, a month and a half Canada tour, and I'd quit my job to do it. I sort of, like... Like, we leave, they called me on a Thursday, I think, and they said, we leave next Friday. Do you want to come? I was like, yes. And I went in the next day and quit my job. And, like, you're not giving us 2 weeks? And I was like, Sorry.
You're kind of that guy. I've known you for a while. Like, you'll jump on a plane to hit the fretboard summit at the drop of a hat.
I did a month and a half with them and then came back and spent a good summer just tooling about doing nothing. And when I'd sort of blown through all my roadie money, I went and started bugging a local guitar shop and just said, you should hire me. Mm-hmm. And finally, I think after, 4 or 5 months of that, they said, we'll give you a shift, you should shut up. Mm-hmm. And that was a shop in Vancouver called Not Just Another Music Shop. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, like when I left, I was like, how long did I work here? Like 9 years? And Kate was like, Kate was the bookkeeper, was like, you were here 12 years.
Wow.
So that was, yeah, it was like the longest job I'd ever had. And it was actually felt kind of like the music shop job, the record store shop. And I actually phoned my buddy and I was like, hey, I found another job, like like the record store.
Even lasted longer.
Yeah, this is fantastic. This is even better. It's like it's like a record store, but even better. But while I was doing that, I was still touring a bit, and I got really sick. I on a tour with this Canadian band out in Ontario. I contracted a very rare blood disease that, if undiagnosed, you just die.
Okay.
And I ended up dropping out of the tour and landed myself in a Toronto hospital. Okay. And I was there for 2 or 3 weeks. And then like lots of misdiagnosis and and they finally figured it out and got me on the right antibiotics. And just as they were about to release me, part of it was from an abscess in my throat. Anyways, these blood clots started floating down into my body and I was in an insane amount of pain. So it was like, I'm just about to get released. And they're like, now you can't be released and you can't fly home. So I was like in the hospital for even longer.
Wow.
But my big epiphany in the hospital was, you know, it was like, what do I like, you know, things that I'd wish that I'd done. And the only thing that I kind of really came up with was like, I kind of wish I'd done post-secondary. Like I had never really occurred to me to do college. Mm-hmm. And I, at that point, really didn't know what I wanted to do. But it just sort of was like, yeah, I would like doing that, I think, whatever that involves. And then sort of, it was sort of a search to like find out, you know, what I should do. And I was like, I study music. And I'm like, I'm never going to be like a nimble fingers dude. Like, that's never going to be me. It doesn't matter if I do it every day. Mm-hmm. That's never going to, I don't think anyways, I could be wrong. Maybe I could get there. But, and I was just sort of searching around and I was out having coffee and I sort of said, yeah, like, you know, like make products better. Like bad products. Like when I see them, especially at the music store at the time, I was like, I would see these products and I'd be like, this is bad. Like,
yeah,
isn't this bad? This seems bad to me. And like, I would do a drawing on a napkin and someone would be like, oh yeah, your way would be way better. Like, yeah, I think it would be way better. And this friend said, do you know what industrial design is? And I said, no, I have no clue. She said, go look. Sounds kind of like what you're talking about. And essentially, yeah, product design.
Yeah.
So while in conjunction working at the music store, I went and did a degree in industrial design, which was 4 years. By the end, I was only doing, I don't know, a day or a week at the music shop just to keep my foot in the door. And
this was when you were in your 30s.
It was my late 20s.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, I did that with sort of the idea that maybe when I left there, I would get a job with, you know, I would love to work with Roland. Like they do, you know, they have this amazing build quality and this access to obviously a huge pool of stuff. But sometimes they just miss the mark. Mm-hmm. And I just assumed that those jobs actually existed. And I remember getting out and like talking to my rep and saying, so like where does the industrial design part of it happen? They're like, they don't do industrial design. It's all the engineers. And I was like, oh, that totally explains it.
What do I do with this degree?
Yeah. And so at the music shop, we started doing sort of build your own pedal workshops.
Okay.
Where you'd pay $100 and come in, and at the end of the way, you walked away with a pedal.
And are you doing those workshops, or were you...
I was participating in it, and it was a guy who would end up being my partner in union, so a guy named Kirk Elliott.
Okay.
So he and I would do the workshops, so I had the shop, and he had the sort of technical know-how.
Yeah.
And that's probably still while I'm in school, and in fact, the first product that still, like, we use the name of, I made one at that workshop, so I called it the Beelzebuzz.
Yeah.
And it was really raw compared to where we got to. Actually, no, it must have been before, because I used that as part of my admission into Emily Carr. But I wish I could have a photo. Somebody out there has this pedal. I've been trying to, like, seek it down. I gave it to Tom Waits.
Of course.
and the story that I heard was, though, that he just, like, left it in the limousine in Vancouver. And so somebody in Vancouver apparently has the original one-of-a-kind Beelzebuzz. It's got, like, vinyl cutout letters. Uh-huh. And I tried to paint the box with spray paint, which you can't spray paint aluminum. It just doesn't work. So I took it to a grinder and, like, grinded off all the paint and then added this, like, fine lettering.
Yeah.
And it looked quite good. And being, the shameless self-promoter, Tom Waits came into the store one day and was like, here, take this. I'm a big fan. He's like, what am I going to do with it? I'm like, I don't know. You're Tom Waits. Do whatever you think is amazing with it.
I'll leave it in a limo.
How about this? How about I do nothing with it? Just leave it in a limousine. He's like, that's pretty good, too. That'll be a great story. The very first thing we did was the Beelzebuzz, and then we would eventually change it. So I shouldn't say this, maybe on this. It's like when one of these, like, it's a product, it's a name in search of a product, because we love the name, so we never want to stop using the name, but it's had like five different versions now, because we got into Long McQuaid's in Canada. It was a big, kind of like their guitar centers, like 60, 70 stores in Canada. And we found that doing anything with them was super, super slow. So whenever we wanted to add a new product, it would take them like 3 or 4 months. So it came time, it was like, I think we were doing it, the Beelzebuzz was maybe a germanium fuzz at one point. We're just like, oh, this is terrible. Let's stop doing that. But let's keep the name, because otherwise we're going to have to discontinue the product and try and introduce a new product, and we're going to go with all this time. So we just keep the name. They'll never know. And
it's like a boy band. You just keep changing out the characters.
Yeah, like a Menudo.
Yeah.
we did that. But
at this point, to be at Long McQuaid, even if one store...
We've jumped ahead.
Every store just has one of your pedals, like, you're in a production mode.
Oh, no, they're not like that. So we were, for a long time, and actually, we were blacked out, is what they called it. So if you... Yeah, it's really weird. So Long McQuaid has this pretty advanced computer system.
Okay.
And if you're in search of a product, they can look across Canada and see if anybody has stock.
Okay.
Unless you're blacked out, which means that, like, if you go into a store in Thunder Bay and look up Union, for the longest time it would just say, they're not part of us. They don't exist. And I had to bug them pretty relentlessly to just, like, hey, what would it take to, you don't have to put one in every store, but just unlock us. So we'd had some encouragement from the Vancouver store, and then, I don't know, the Toronto store wanted some, and Calgary was a signature store, and so there's more stores that have a little bit of our stuff, but I don't think it's in everyone. I don't know.
All right. But you're working at the guitar store. Electronics guru guy who ends up being your partner.
Yeah, so we'd done the workshops together, and then I kind of had this idea to do, it's like, well, one was not that, you know, one was okay. Building one pedal was okay. Like, let's build 10 and see how it goes. And I went to him with an idea, and I just said, hey, like, you know, look at this. Do you think this would be hard to do? And he said, no, not hard, but, like, if it didn't work, would you know how to test it? And I said, I wouldn't have the slightest idea. And he said,
like a schematic? Or this?
Yeah, it was okay. A schematic that I pulled out of an old thing that I wanted. It was hard to find thing. I'm not going to say what it is,
because
people always give me grief about it. But I just sort of said, I was trying to buy one of these, and I couldn't buy one. Like, they just weren't available. And But I found a schematic in the back of one and pulled it out and photocopied it and put it back in.
Yeah.
And that my boss owned at the old music shop. And I took it to him and I said, you know, how hard would this be to do? And he said, no, not hard, but, you know, yeah, I couldn't test it. And I said, no. He said, well, why don't we do it together? So I said, yeah, that sounds good. So we did a run of 20 pedals, 25 pedals maybe, of a unit that we called the Buzz Bomb.
Okay.
And sold them to Vancouver guys, and they kind of went reasonably fast. It's a cool unit, and we'd just taken them to try and make... It was like, how could we make these look interesting without, you know, doing something really expensive? And I hadn't thought tons of it, but we had a friend of mine just take them... he's a jeweler.
Okay.
And he polished all the boxes, so they kind of look like polished aluminum, which looked really unusual.
Okay.
And then we took them to a trophy shop, and the trophy shop engraved them for us with the names. And I think even at that point, we were doing maybe some with... If somebody pre-ordered it, we'd, like, put their name as the model or something. So,
still doing?
A little bit. Usually now it's just if we're courting an artist, we'll put their name as the serial number. So if somebody that we're trying to... That doesn't know us and we really want them to use our stuff, if we're cold sending them something, we might do that.
Trying to avoid the Tom Waits situation again.
Yeah, I guess. And then maybe know where, you know, like... If it shows up down the road, we know that that person didn't use it.
Yeah.
And also, if it gets stolen from, or, you know, if they actually have it and it gets stolen and there's an unusual serial number.
Yeah.
That's going to help it find its way back. So, yeah, we did that, sold well. And then it was like, hey, we've got this other name. It's the Beelzebuzz. Let's do some of those. And we made some of those. And they didn't sell well. They sold really poorly. And I was like, oh, maybe we're not hitting the mark here.
Yeah.
And... Then we, I was really just sort of thinking about how we could rebrand and stuff. I was sort of, I'm sure I was probably, you know, thinking I've got to, I really got to make something of myself. And I was in a thrift store and found this, I think it was a tackle box or something that said Union Made. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's it. That's the name. Like, mm-hmm. It's going to be. Because up until then, we were calling it Luxury Transistor, which I just thought was funny, because, like, there's nothing luxurious about transistors, but
yeah.
People always like, oh, they're germanium, they're this and that, like, oh, a bunch of nonsense. But I was like, union, like, that's really good. Like, I really liked the idea, and then also, like, the double meaning, sort of, you know, because I really did, like, I was sort of getting into this thing where there was people who were such tube purists, but, you know, realizing that Neve recording gear was amazing, and that I didn't necessarily like the people that were just trying to, like, I'm gonna have a tube console in my room even though it's like 100 degrees in here.
Yeah.
And, you know, all tube, all tape. And I was like, I like the stuff that I like is really a mix, you know, like I like solid state consoles, and I like tube amps, and I like solid state pedals, and I like...
Yeah.
So I like this, and I was like, oh, tube and transistor. Like, that's, yeah, it's kind of... So now people always think that, is there tubes in these pedals? I'm like, no.
Not yet.
No. Well, they were actually, before I wanted to do pedals, I wanted to do amps, and I just, like, I couldn't fathom how I was going to get the money to do amps.
Yeah.
But I was like, a pedal's kind of manageable, you know? It's not... I mean, it's not off the charts expensive. It's funny to me now, because we get people... online who are constantly like, hey, you know, I could do that pedal that these guys are doing for $10. And I was like, what are we doing wrong? Like, there's no way you could build these pedals for $10. Like, you're out of your mind if you think you can do that. Like, or alternately, you should have a job. So if anybody's listening out there and thinks they can do our pedals for $10, send us an email and you might have a job. Because, yeah, that's not what our stuff costs.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I wanted to do amps, wanted to do pedals, wanted to do this sort of hybrid. It was sort of like, it would be great if we could do all of the things that you want. It would be great if you could have a complete Union tube and transistor rig.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we did the badges. My ex-girlfriend, who was a graphic designer from... Emily Carr designed this amazing logo that we were, as soon as we saw it, just went, yeah, that's perfect. Like, yeah. It was just, it summed up the feeling that that we were looking for. And we started, actually, even before we were doing the badges, we started doing t-shirts and doing guerrilla marketing. So we were dropping t-shirts off at thrift stores.
Okay.
Just so that they would show up and people would be like, what is this? And we made this real effort not to go online. So we were doing it for quite a while, but we weren't online. If you searched us, you couldn't find anything about us.
Yeah.
And we kind of liked that idea. So yeah, we were just sort of doing this, like, how, let's promote the brand. It was something, well, when I was in school, I did a paper talking about Blue Note and Sub Pop.
Sure.
And the similarities between them.
Yeah.
And one of the big things with them was that they always just promoted the brand.
Yeah.
So you knew that Blue Note was good regardless.
Sure.
Of it. And same with kind of Sub Pop for, I don't know what it's like now, but for a long time you felt that way. It's like, oh, Sub Pop is probably going to be good.
Yeah.
And so one of the things was, if you looked at our stuff from a distance, I was sort of like thinking, like, the person peering up on stage, they can't actually see, you can't read the model number because it's too small, but you can see the name, you can see Union. So it was sort of like, oh, they're using a Union. And that's how people would start talking about our stuff. It was like, oh, that guy's got a Union, he's got this. And, like, not talking specifically about any one or the other. It's just, he's got a Union. And, so we started doing slightly bigger runs. And superstitiously, we decided never to do the serial number 13.
Yeah.
I think there's maybe actually a couple Third Man ones that have 13s in them, I guess. So we never blocked those out, so there's probably some of those.
Jack White should be worried.
Uh-oh.
His empire.
Well, no, here's the thing, though. So instead of 13, we would just pick an artist that we really liked and send them something.
Okay.
So we'd skip the serial number, but we would make something in its place. So I guess if those are 13s, I don't know. And so they're lucky 13s. Yeah, we had this list of who were the ultimate players that we would want using our stuff, and we sort of... It was... a little bit about that they should be people that people talk about.
Sure.
Like, at one point I was like, we should send something to Josh Holm. And it's like, no, he doesn't want people talking about his gear.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like, I might as well, like, take $300 and set it on fire, because it's no good sending him something if he's not going to. So there's this sort of specific list of people that we thought were interesting and that people talked about. And so every, it wasn't a lot, but every 100 pedals, we would send out one.
Yeah.
And we sent stuff to, one of them was to Jack White.
Yeah.
And unlike a lot of people, they responded really quickly.
Yeah.
And were really enthusiastic and asked if we could, like, would you be willing to work on guitars and do stuff? I'm like, I wasn't quite at first. I didn't really understand at first what he was saying. I was like, what do you, I'm not really understanding. He's like, would you put one of these in his guitar? I was like, yeah, we could do that, but you might not want to, and here's why. We gave sort of some technical explanations. And then
Jack White wanted it inboard on his
whatever. He has some guitar with a micro amp on board, and he wanted to replace it with one of the ones that we were doing. And I said, well, yeah, you might, here's, you know, could work, might not, but I'm, yeah, we'd be willing to try.
Yeah.
And then it was like, finally we just said, hey, we could build you something. Mm-hmm. We could just make something for you. And they said, well, that sounds great. And ended up meeting up and brought a bunch of ideas down. Said, this is some stuff that was just aesthetics. So at that time, there was a no-knob fuzz in the bunch that I brought down. Mm-hmm. And some other stuff that... which is a variety of stuff. And he very quickly went, I like the look of that, and I like the sound of that.
Mm-hmm.
Can you bury those two? And went, yeah, that wouldn't be a problem. And made a deal to do, like, I think 50 pedals or something, nothing huge. But 50 became 100, 100 became 200. And they also didn't want anybody knowing about it. So I spent the better part of 2 years denying that anything had happened with them. And
when was this? When was the first deal?
2011, I guess, would have been when we sort of went there and came to an agreement. But 2013, before it actually saw the light of day, maybe even 2010.
Let's go back a bit, because we've already fast-forwarded to the Jack White chapter, but you have this, like, you've nailed your aesthetic. It's amazing. It's like Blue Note. Like, you know a Union pedal it from the minute you see it.
Right.
The colors, the design, the minimalism, it's beautiful.
Yep.
What is your overall thinking process on, like, what's on the inside? Are you thinking about vintage pedals you saw back at the guitar store and wanting to replicate? Is there sounds that you've wanted that you just can't find? Like, what?
Yeah, there was definitely, I had a few, there was a few players whose sounds I wanted access to. I didn't want to be like tribute acts to them, but it was like, I wanted to be able to go to this, like, the paint store and buy those colors.
Okay. Who were some of those?
The three big ones for me were Neil Young, Daniel Lanois, and The Edge.
Okay.
For sure. Like, hands down, those were the guys. Was just like they were of a type of player that I have a great amount of respect for, and none of them are particularly flash, you know? Like, they were, I'm never going to be a Steve Vai, but I could do a huge E chord and sound like Neil Young.
Sure.
You know? So, yeah, they were, just tastefully, but also in, like, attainability in my reality. those were guys that I was like, I want those. And I did research and I knew how some of it went down, and I owned pieces, you know, I'd acquired pieces of gear that they owned. But to some degree, I always felt like there was sort of some mythology, and then if you could get to the heart of that, there was some truth as well. So it was like, well, you know, why do they like these, or... Mm-hmm. What's really going on? It's not, you know, it's not what everybody thinks it is. Maybe that's part of it. So, yeah, part of it was I just wanted access to those sounds, but I also didn't want vintage gear. Like, not that I don't like vintage gear, but, like, hunting down a vintage tone bender and trying to make it work on my pedal board seemed awful to me. But it's like, well, if we were going to do that, what could you do better? I was like, well, vintage ones aren't that loud. You know, if we're going to do one, let's make it louder.
Yeah.
It's like, and fuzz face clones, people do them, and they don't work on your daisy chain. So let's fix that. And they don't work, you know, some of them, they don't want to be after a buffered pedal. It's like, let's fix that. And then it's like, so in the end, it was like, well, here, this sounds kind of like that.
Yeah.
But we've made some improvements in, you know, two or three small areas that hopefully the artist doesn't ever have to think about.
Yeah.
It's way out of their mind, but it just was like, oh, this is great, and it works better.
Yeah.
It's like, it's kind of got that vintage vibe, but it works better. And so that was part of our thing, was like this vintage aesthetic, but under the hood, a few modern tricks here and there to sort of bring it up to date. So, but again, the stuff that ideally, just as a musician, I don't ever want to think of that stuff.
Sure.
You know, as technically as a builder, I was like, yeah, we need to think about that. But hopefully for them, it's going to work. It's going to sound good. And then that's the most they have to think about it, you know.
Yeah.
Hopefully it never breaks on them. And if it does, that they send it to us and we fix it. Unlike, you know, somebody who's like, well, this is disposable.
Yeah.
You know, I spent $120 on it, and now I'm going to go spend $120 on another new one. It's like, our stuff's a bit more expensive, but you send it to us and we'll fix it for you.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think I've ever turned somebody away, even people that I've just know have done something silly.
Yeah.
I got a few of those with the Jack White one where people, my kid had an adapter around the house and it fit, so we plugged it in. Like, oh, no. And then it released the magic smoke, and I was like, oh, yeah. Send it in. We'll fix it.
Wow. So your partner on this is, what's his name again?
Kirk Elliott.
Kirk. And does he come at it with his own views, or are you kind of the visionary of what you want these pedals to sound like?
It started off, a lot of it was my idea, his execution, but he's definitely come into his own, and like the lab compressor, the new one that we've just come up with, is pure him. Mm-hmm. I might have said to him, do you have an idea for a compressor? And then he went, yeah, I do. You know, like that was the gist of the conversation. Part of it was that we've never delved into digital. So that even though there's digital things that would super be intrigued to do, it's not really in our wheelhouse. So, and I know there's a limit to how interesting gains are for some people. In fact, what's weird to me is if you'd asked me early on, I would have said, I don't want to do any gains. I would just want to do weird modulation and delay stuff because that's what really intrigues me.
Yeah.
But distortion has a pretty broad appeal. It's, you know, when somebody finds the right one, mm-hmm. You can see it. And the real funny one to me is especially with our preamp, how many guys are just like, I don't ever play without it.
Yeah.
Like just guys in especially in Vancouver, which has been huge for us, is just tons of guys just like, that's my favorite pedal. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's not just a preamp, but it's a preamp, right? And to have people go, it's one knob and it's $300. How good could it be? And it's like, try it out. You tell me. I think it's pretty good.
Yeah.
And a lot of them, I think it's, you know, yeah, you can have it when you pry it from my cold dead hands. Like, I'm never giving it up. I did a show, the least amount of pedals that I've ever played a show with last year, I did it with a Moore and a tuner.
Yeah.
And usually that would just make me feel completely naked, but I was fine. I can live with that setup. Yeah.
And what, when you decided to make the Moore,
yep.
Like what was the idea there? Like what's going on in the guts there that separates it from all the others?
There's a number of things. It's one of those ones that it's a lot of us making choices so that other people won't have to. Mm-hmm. But the big things with it are taking what is essentially a studio grade mic pre, mm-hmm. and shoving it into a pedal box and making it run at 9 volts. That's like, I'm sure what Rye Cooter is doing with preamps in his guitar setup, mm-hmm. is not wildly different from what we're doing, except he's running $1,000 a channel. What does he run? Sneeves?
Yeah, he's got that weird thing now. I don't know. Yeah.
You know, and same with like he's got some, you know, photo cell compressor, right?
Yeah.
So it's not so much that we have, we haven't done something that's undoable. It's just that we've made it accessible and pedal board friendly.
Yeah.
And that's always, you know, it's like if we can't do it at 9 volts, like how worth it is it? And that also there's other problems even if you get into like, yeah, we could have done a 110 volt version really easily, but then it would be a North American product.
Sure.
It wouldn't be an international product. I couldn't ship it everywhere and just say, yep, use a standard Boss adapter.
Yeah.
It'll work fine with a standard Boss adapter. To me, that's huge. When I see stuff, it's like this requires 110, 240, 18 volts, reverse polarity. All I think is like if I had a gig in Lethbridge and my adapter went down on a Saturday night, would I be screwed? And it's like, yeah, with that piece of gear, you probably would.
Yeah.
With something that runs off of a regular Boss 9-volt adapter, you're probably going to get through the gig.
Yeah.
You know? If it can run off a battery, even better. But, you know, some of our stuff, just we've had to admit that batteries aren't part of their life.
Yeah.
But that's, again, just stuff that I don't want people to think about. I want them to think, oh, this works. I don't want them to think, oh, I need special power.
Yeah.
And in fact, it was funny, I used to collect some vintage Echo units, and I'd come down to Seattle to sell some to somebody.
Okay.
And on the way home from the trip, I went to a shop and saw this pedal, and I was like, what's that? And the guy described it, and I was like, oh no, it sounds like what I've just finished building. Mm-hmm. And I had this slight heart attack moment. I tried it and I was like, oh wow, it's really close to what we've done. It's not exact,
yeah,
but it's awfully close. And then I said, what's the story with this adapter? And he's like, oh, it's a special 48-volt adapter. And I went, well, we've got them beat.
Yeah, yeah.
Ours doesn't need a specialized 48-volt adapter.
Yeah.
Like, you're done. You've just, like, it could be so great, but how many people are going to integrate that?
Yeah. Are there things you've wanted to do but that won't work? You can't get the Voss adapter won't?
Not yet.
Yeah.
No. I mean, there's some, like, with the compressor, I think it was hard, but not impossible. There was other challenges with it. I mean, there's 9 volts is one challenge, and there's any number of them. I don't think there's a couple things that we're working on that'll probably be 110 products.
Okay.
In the mid 90s, Kirk made now somewhat sought after guitar splitter for the studio.
Okay.
Let you run one guitar and power 6 amps.
Okay.
And some other companies have done similar products, and a lot of them, that's the nice way to put it, probably used his product as a launching point.
Sure.
How about that?
Okay.
Anyways, he made them in 95. His box was called the GBX95. Anyone wants to look it up? His old company was called Systematic Sound.
Okay.
If you look them up, they're really interesting, and they're one of those, they're seemingly simple, but behind the scenes doing stuff for you that you don't have to think about. So it's just guitar in, mute or not, and then out to 6 amps, mute on or off, and a phase switch. So they're very simple, but
okay.
If you can imagine actually the technical difficulties of running 6 amps in the studio, it solves a problem for the people that want to do those big setups. He was approached recently by Avid about making one of these for them. And we kind of thought, well, if we're going to make one, shouldn't we make a few? And rather than it being systematic, you know, unions had a little bit more traction. Well, let's release it as a union product. And a few people chimed in, like, you should do this. You should put a Moore circuit in there. And we just thought, no, this is going to be, we're referring to it as a resurrection. So it's an exact reproduction of the old product. The only difference will be that where it said Systematic Sound, it'll say Union.
Okay.
But that'll be a 110 power product.
That's coming out later this year? Or?
It's in process right now. I think we were just waiting on some handles. It's, in fact, we're only going to do a few of them. I think we're starting with maybe 5.
Okay.
One for Avid, a couple for some studios in Vancouver, and then there'll be a few for sale. But the first run will probably actually have the old circuit boards in them. He still had some circuit board stock. Wow. So then rather than actually making new circuit boards, we're repurposing it. So it's just a different faceplate, quite literally.
So get in early is what you're saying.
If you want one, it's an unusual product. There's other stuff out there that's tried to be this product. And the funny thing is talking to the guys who have them, you know, like, Garth Richards and Bob Rock and people like that who have the originals. It's like, hey, are you interested in another one? It's like, no, I have one and it's amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I'm not giving mine up anytime soon, but no, I don't need another one. It's built like a tank.
Yeah.
And those guys use them all the time.
Sure.
Yeah.
So let's go back to the Jack White thing. At that point, it's the two of you guys. I imagine a small room. You're scrambling to make pedals as people order them. Maybe
it was
wrong?
Literally in my kitchen at that point. The first Jack White, the third man run was me for a few weeks. I mean, not a few weeks, like better part of a year in getting everything ready. Mm-hmm. And then in my pajamas doing circuit boards for a couple weeks. And then actually more than that, a couple months maybe. I don't know. It was a lot because we were still doing everything. And then having some friends come around and like help us build in my kitchen and just like picking up two pedals and moving them to one surface so that you had another free surface because it was my kitchen table. And there's pedals everywhere. And at the end of the day, trying to clean that up and just became crazy. But in the end, I had a stack of nearly 300 pedals in my living room, which was just like, it looked awesome. It just looked like a giant stack of boxes when it was all done. It just, the sigh of relief.
Yeah.
And we sent those off, and we were sort of in a holding pattern, but it felt like things were doing better. We still weren't online at this point. We hadn't, or we would have had a Facebook page, but no website. That's a good story about that. But we started, like, I can't do this in my house anymore. My girlfriend's going to leave me.
Yeah.
We kind of took a step off the cliff, not knowing if there was something to like land on, and we signed a lease on a small studio, and maybe I kind of think how it would have been, but maybe we signed it in October or early November.
Okay.
And the pedals for Third Man went on sale on Black Friday, and they pretty much sold out in about 3 days, which was unbelievable to me. And they placed another order with us. So it's like, well, we've got the space and we've got this. We just need some time. So
yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's really just the two of you, though. Or you.
No, there was... I had a few other friends who were touring musicians and techs who just, you know, like, hey, if you have 4 hours of downtime, come on over and do some assembly. And I would get them doing the part where it's like, put all the hardware in and then slide it over to me and I do the final solder, mm-hmm. put it away. And then when we had enough, you know, we had 20 up soldered up, we'd test them all. And then half of them would fail and then we'd fix those.
Really?
No, it's not that bad. It was pretty good. But they were all sort of just buddies of ours who was like, you got some time?
Yeah.
You know, come in and throw a few hours here and there. And then there's even actually early on in the probably Facebook or something, there's pictures of like when we moved into the studio and we had like one IKEA table like this size.
Yeah.
With like three guys working around it. Yeah. And very quickly we're like,
tiny table.
It's like, yeah, a tiny table. It's like very quickly it's like, this isn't going to work.
Yeah.
Go out and buy the biggest boardroom table that you can find. Let's like, and like got that. It's like, okay, this is already better.
Yeah.
And my girlfriend had come up with this brilliant idea. It's like, what about, you know, baking racks? And I was like, baking racks? Yeah, that's fantastic. And we went and bought a cooling rack.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. With the big removable aluminum trays. And those actually hold, of our pedals anyways, they hold 20 pedals just about perfectly.
Yeah.
So rather than moving two pedals over to a shelf and then going back into two pedals, like, here's a tray of 20. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of really quickly see how far along in the building process you were. I was like, oh, this is great. So this is all to that stage. Put it on the shelf. Go grab another tray. And that immediately sped up things for us. But it was still, you know, we're doing 20 at a time. It's not...
Yeah.
We're not doing hundreds and we're not doing thousands.
Are the boxes and the... Is it powder coated? What is it?
Yeah.
Like, is that a process where you can do 20 at a time and see how the company goes, or do you have to order 100?
No, you pay a little bit more.
Yeah.
Usually, depending on a product now, when we launch something new, it's 20 pieces, which is not huge. I'm sure, you know, there's other pedal companies out there probably laugh at us, like, 20 pedals. Like, well,
got to see how it does.
See how it does, you know, like, and some of them, like the compressor, we kind of knew ahead of time that it was going to be a little bit more than what we thought, but that was still only, the initial run was only 40 pieces.
Yeah.
And we sold them out right away. So it was like, okay, let's start on 40 or 60 more.
Yeah.
And those sold out right away. It's like, okay, well, start on another 40.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, it's like our stuff's never huge. It's always more about the quality and just, let's just do it at a level that's attainable. Let's not overextend ourselves. Let's, you know, be able to still give people really good customer service. When I was on a tour once with one of my bands, and a guy in Toronto had written me saying, yeah, one of my pedals is doing this thing. It's not good. And I was, oh, we, we've come up with a fix for that. What's your address? And he gave me his address, and I went to his house and knocked on his door. And it's like, he's like, what the hell? This is the best customer service I've ever gotten. And I went to another shop there and borrowed a soldering iron and modded it for him and took it back to his house.
Nice.
Yeah. So, but I, you know, like, I don't do that all the time, but it's just happened to be the
right thing. You really
should. Everywhere. Yeah, you don't send it to us. We'll come to you.
Do you still enjoy hanging out in front of and top of a soldering iron and doing all that?
Or yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
I mean, you've done this thousands of times now. There's got to be a few thousand union pedals out in the world.
Yeah, there's probably. Yeah, I do. It's just working by myself, kind of relaxing. I listen to podcasts. I listen to Fretboard Journal podcasts.
Oh, thank you.
I listen to Steve Dawson's wonderful podcast that we also sponsor. I listen to, I don't know, This American Life and other stuff like that. I listen to music. I listen to the Beatles and just work away and do it. So, yeah, I do still. There is something very satisfying about making real things. Like, you know, it's, there's something about me that wants to love software, but, like, it just doesn't have any, like, try selling your used software.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just, it's not as much to me. But like a product that I can hold in my hand and I kind of know, like, this is probably going to be around long after I'm gone.
Yeah.
You know, this is, that feels good. And it's also, there's some stuff just in our quality of build. So one of Kirk's actually an electronics engineer.
Yeah.
So he's actually got a degree and he's like, he's the real deal.
Yeah.
You know, I've brought him, I've played him pedals and then had him draw the schematic from what he thinks it is, which is just, that's some next level stuff. But he's amazing. He's just like, I think here's what I think it is. And then we'll crack it open and look. And it's like, yep, that's what it is. Like, holy, how did you do that? And he's just got tons and tons of experience and he understands it in a way that a lot of people don't. But he studied, when he was studying, he studied under a British ex-military guy.
Okay.
Who was like, there's a right way and a wrong way. Mm-hmm. And so every once in a while I'll talk about, you know, hey, could we do this? Could we fudge this? And he just kind of, no, we can't. There's a right way and a wrong way. And you're talking about doing it the wrong way. Okay. Yeah, sure.
Is he next to you pretty much every day, or is he like the wizard? He hides in his engineering cave. And
yeah, he's in his cave, okay. And I'm in the studio. And I mean, we talk, not maybe every day, but every second or third day, and we're on the phone together. And I, you know, I'll get some weird idea late at night and just call him up, and I've got an idea.
Yeah,
we don't have to do it now, but we should do this. Sometime, put it in the back of your brain and let it filter through a bit. Okay.
So let's talk a little bit about the union lineup.
Okay.
You mentioned the compressor.
Yep.
How many pedals do you offer right now? Like, are actually in production?
I don't actually know. It's probably somewhere between 10 and 12.
Okay.
If I name them. Okay. So there's More, Evermore, Tone Druid, Swindle, Tour Bender, Sound Bender, Zarbomba, Bumblebuzz, Subbuzz, Beelzebuzz, Lab, Pop, Snap.
13.
Yeah. We just dropped off the first Snap somewhere yesterday. They're actually not in production, so it's sort of a last prototype.
What's the Snap? Let's don't leave
The Snap. Well, so we did a. There's, Kirk came up with this amazing piece of technology. So, there's stuff that we do. Like, people always are like, you should patent that, and it's like, you get a patent lawyer and fight that fight. It's like, let's just make it hard for people to do. And Kirk came up with this amazing idea. So, okay, I'm going to backtrack a little bit. We did the More, and people really liked the More, but every once in a while people would ask for the More with a master volume.
Yep.
Well, it's a preamp, so it's like a preamp with a master volume. It's like you boost it and then you turn it down. That doesn't really make any sense. But as I thought about what people were really asking for, it was they wanted the more with how it interacted with the first tube in their amp with a master volume after that.
Yeah.
So we did a version of the Moore circuit with an analog simulation of a 12AX7 with a master volume after that.
Okay.
That was the Tone Druid. And it's been a pretty consistent seller for us. I think it's the Klon killer. It's an overdrive, but really it just sounds like another channel of a 12AX7 based amp. So if you have a 12AX7 based amp, which is 95% of guitar amps.
Yeah.
It's like you've just added another channel
to
that amp, which is cool because it doesn't screw with your guitar. It doesn't screw with the amp. It's just giving you sort of a bit of grit in what you already have. And the name. The name is good on that one, too. So when we released the Third Man product, people were cursing us for our price point and lack of controls, and this one guy said, what the hell is with these guys, like $300 for a no knob fuzz? Are they made by Canadian Tone Druids? I was like, oh, that's really good, we're gonna steal that. So whoever that guy is out there, he's the one who named our product for us. We had the name and it's like, what would the Tone Druid be? And it's like, oh, kind of, that's what this should be. It should be something that is difficult to maybe conceptualize, but then when you hear it, go, oh yeah, this is sort of what I've been hunting for. So then fast forward, we had that out for a while, and I was listening to some Beatles records, and there's these sounds that appear on Beatles records that I've always kind of wondered about, and it's like, and I was sort of, you know, going through my memory bank and going through that recording the Beatles book, and like, you know, what would they have had access to? It's like, it's not a fuzz.
Yeah,
I know when they use fuzz, and I know they did stuff direct, but I don't think it's that. And I was like, I bet you they had treble boosters. So I started looking at treble boosters and what was interesting about them, and then this sort of repeating thread came up, which was that treble boosters are really interesting, but turning them on and off is too weird.
Yeah.
Because you go from like to back to your normal thing, and it's just this weirdness. So this light bulb went off in my head that said, well, if we took that Tone Druid circuit and replaced the Moore part of it with a treble booster, you might have something really interesting. And that's the Pop. So we made this pedal called the Pop. And it's, I don't know, it's a little bit the redheaded stepchild. Nobody seems to love it but me.
Okay.
I think it's, I thought it was kind of a wonderful thing, but it is, it's a fairly...
You've only made one, right?
No, we did a run of this. Pop came out last year.
Okay.
And I don't know, we only built like 20 of them or something. Okay. I don't think we've even sold the first 20.
Okay.
But I liked them. It was appealing to me. And it's one of those ones, especially if you try it in a store, it doesn't make any sense because you're not in your band context. But in a band context or recording context, it
works.
It works. It makes sense. In a recording context, I guess a traditional treble booster would work. But this does something interesting because you have this simulated 12AX7 circuit. And after playing with it for a while, my partner sort of said, well, if you were going to do it again, what would you change?
Yeah.
I said, well, it'd be nice if you could smooth it out, you know, just if it had some way to bring back some of the bass. You don't have to bring it all back, but just bring back some. And so he took another stab at it, and, we added a third, it's a different type of treble booster. But there's a third knob that lets you reintroduce bass, and that's the snap. And the effect being that, like, if the Pop sounds like weird, janky Beatles things, the snap sounds like a smoother Brian May kind of vibe. Maybe? Like, it's still in that thing, but it's interesting because it's because you have control. You have this way to sort of do what it would be like to goose your amp, but in a enclosed package. So you're not... You can rip your head off with it if you want, but you don't have to be.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. And then I know people were going nuts for the compressor.
Yeah. The thing there, so this is the longest we've ever spent developing a product. So it was 2.5 years from, I think, acquiring some of the initial parts to test and going through these long processes of how are we going to do this. the big thing that we did with this one, which we hadn't done before, now we're doing a bit more, we're actually having parts made for us. Okay. So we approached a company in Japan to make potentiometers, and those are fantastic. We're basically now phasing into all of their potentiometers because they're just wonderful.
Okay.
But we also made our own, we didn't originally know that we were going to have to do this. And this was actually one of the things with it was, if when I'd been like starting it out, someone said, this is going to be 2.5 years and thousands and thousands of dollars, I would have said, let's just do another fuzz pedal.
Yeah.
Fuzz pedals are easy. Do a fuzz pedal. Fuzz pedals take like a couple months. You know, the pop went from a concept to on the shelves within 2 months or something, which is the fastest we've ever released a product. And then on the other end of it, we have something that's been 2.5 years, like the longest we've ever developed a product. But we made our own optocouplers.
Okay.
So each lab has 3 custom optocouplers in it, which was just a nightmare. It was a knock 'em down, drag 'em out battle of, you know, you get a part and then test it and it works. And it's like, okay, we'll take 1,000 of them. And we get them and they're wrong. And then it's like, okay, send them back. Send them all back. And like, they send them to us the second time. They're wrong again. It's like, okay, that's not going to work.
Is there one company that you have to go to for all this? Or
yeah, there's kind of one main optocoupler in the game. And I think eventually we'd found some that they worked and we could get them, but the difference was we were going to have to make our own enclosures and we would essentially have to make optocouplers. And then I had this sort of, because it had been such an awful process getting to that point, it's like, we should buy enough that this isn't an issue for at least a few years again. So yeah, we invested in a few thousand pieces or enough to make a few thousand pieces of those.
Okay.
But that was a lot of money. That was like $12,000 or something, which is for us insane. Yeah. Like my credit card's maxed out at the moment because we used money to do that. And
sure.
But then the reaction's been good. So the big one is that like studio people have been figuring out that this is a really good compressor, never mind at, you know, the budget, but just even at any price point. And I've had friends even who've put it up against the Universal Audio plugin, and they're like, yeah, yours is better than the plugin.
Wow.
So it's like, yeah, that's great. So it's been 2.5 years and we've been lucky, you know, but we also, you're lucky because you're ready when the opportunity is there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So putting aside the maxed out credit card, you've got the aesthetic thing. You've clearly got a vision. You wanted to do amps.
Yep.
Have you thought about guitars?
I have. I was mentioning to you before. I thought about an electric guitar, and that just seemed unattainable to me. I struggle, despite having what I feel is a pretty good vision of what I don't want and stuff. Electric guitars is one that I can't see into the future of what I want there. So I'd love to work on something, maybe find the right person and work with them. But we did do an acoustic guitar a few years ago.
Very odd for me to hear.
But yeah. It's a one-off at this point, but it was a flat top that had some retro stylings without being, I don't know, not fake aged and not, sort of looked like a guitar that could have come out of the past and dropped into the future. And in fact, actually, I sent a photo of it to my friend when we finished it. He said, "What year is that thing?" I was like, "Oh, perfect.
That's perfect."
Yeah. And I worked on that with a luthier from Vancouver named Dave Reimer, who's a fantastic, fantastic builder. If I could, you know, figure out a way to have him build them and produce them inexpensively, or, you know, not inexpensively, but attainably. If anybody wants one, we could probably build you one, but it might be pricey. They're the one turned out really nice, but it was a long-ish process. I sold that one and might build another one for myself. So
it's like a dreadnought or a smaller body or
like an OM. Yeah.
And what kind of woods?
It was rosewood, spruce.
Yeah.
And the neck might have been mahogany that was from a Larrivée dumpster find.
Okay.
For the prototype. but just, yeah, I was saying before, I think, like, there's a certain kind of vibe to guitars where if they're too fancy, they're a little bit embarrassing to me. And so I've always, part of my thing is stuff that's, you know, I like one knob fuzz pedals. I like guitars that don't have crazy finishes or ornate inlay or, although I do own a White Penguin, so.
Yeah, there you go. You can't, yeah.
Straddle both sides. But I would never play it out. I would never play it out. Yeah. And then there's an amplifier in the works. The prototype is sort of getting its final vetting.
Okay.
Is
this finally the tube part?
This is the tube part of Union Tube and Transistor. Yeah, so... at the old shop, the old music shop that I worked at, the amps that we would constantly, and we still do, the amps that people want are a Princeton Reverb, a Deluxe Reverb, and a Vibralux Reverb, like three of the greatest amps ever made. But I was flipping through, there's an old, you might have a copy of it, there's an old tube, Aspen Pittman maybe?
Yeah, the book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was flipping through it and I was looking at the schematics and I was just like, kind of flipping back and forth between the three of them, and it's like, I think it's just marketing. I think they would love us to think that those are three different amps, but they're kind of the same amp.
Yeah.
And at the time, I still own a couple of those, and I owned a Vibralux, which I've since sold. But I took them down to my studio at the time, and just started swapping the cabinets.
Yeah.
So plugging the Vibralux into the Princeton speakers, putting the Princeton into the deluxe mm-hmm. And what I quickly came up with was, well, the speakers make a huge difference, mm-hmm. but the amps, the difference is, I mean, it's there maybe, but it's pretty nominal. It's not as significant as people would like to make mm-hmm. out. So I started humming and hawing about that, and it's like, well, what if you could put all three in one? That would be a really nice amp. That would be a handy thing. So the Union amp is a pair of 6V6, a single channel reverb. But what really makes it unique is that it offers speaker switching. So it has a 10-inch and a 12-inch, and you can have one, the other, or both.
Okay.
And you can flip it in real time. So you can be playing it, and somebody could dial it back and forth for you. You don't have to turn it down and switch. There's no harm to actually switching it. It switches impedance for you.
Very cool.
Yeah. So I haven't seen that.
Bright colors like your pedals?
Yes, garish, very garish. The prototype is black Tolex, wheat grill, and ultimately I think it's probably going to have something kind of like a piece of red SG wood to sort of finish it off. So
okay.
Sort of not really outside of our wheelhouse. The one thing I'm struggling with is a name. So if anyone's got a great name,
okay, I'll
give you a good deal on a model if you can come up with a good name.
Awesome.
Yeah, and we did other stuff too. Just trying to. It's. I mean, the nice thing is it's not a lot heavier even than my vintage Deluxe Reverb. Mm-hmm. So the cabinet's pine, the chassis is aluminum. And it sounds great. I've been playing it for about a year, mm-hmm. just sort of putting it through its paces to see how I like it. And there's some nice stuff that you get with the 10-12 mix. Part of the idea for me was, if you think of how Matchless took on Vox,
sure,
they sort of said, what's wrong with, you know, what goes wrong with a Vox, or how could you improve on those? I was like, in my mind, thinking, well, what if you did that with Fender? If you did what Fender did, but did a little bit better than that. you get some of the, but you also kind of get some of that mixed harmonic thing with the two different size speakers. And for recording, you can record each one individually.
Yeah.
And I even was approached by a country artist, and this would have never occurred to me, but he said, you know, my in-ear guys, I want 12s in my ear, and the front of house guy wants 10s. I was like,
interesting.
There you go. You can have both in one amp. You don't have to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which was something I never would have occurred to me, because in-ears is just not part of my world, but.
And it can run off a 9-volt Boss adapter.
Yep, yeah, 9-volt Boss adapter anywhere in the world, so that shouldn't be a problem. Yeah, we did other. I mean, we did little things. There's little tweaks here and there, just like small stuff that bugs me about amps. That was like, oh, could we fix that? So like, the way Fender had, you know, they screw in a reverb tank into the bottom of the amp.
Sure.
We use snaps. Just unsnap, and you can pull up the bag and swap the tank out if you want. It's real easy.
Yeah.
No things. And then I've always, so a Marshall, modern Marshall amps have detachable IEC cables.
Yeah.
And a Fender amp has a built-in cable. So there's nice things about both of those, right? The Fender one, no one's going to steal your cable.
Yeah.
And the Marshall one, if somebody damages the end of it, you don't have to go to a shop to have it repaired to do your gig. You can just grab another cable and do it. So we actually, for ours, we used a locking cable that's bolted in and locks in, which means that it's hard for someone to steal it, for one.
Yeah.
But if it does get damaged, you can unlock it, put another IEC and finish your gig. So it's kind of the best of both to me. Yeah. Little things like that.
Yeah.
It's like little tweaks here and there that it's like all these companies should be doing that. But
you mentioned the country artist with the idea for the in-ear monitor.
Yep.
These number 13 pedals that you send out to people, have you gotten a lot of positive feedback, or have you made changes based off what some of these well-known artists have told you?
There hasn't been, I mean, there's not too much that people are asking us to change, I guess.
Yeah.
It's just sort of, it's usually just a yes or a no. Like they either like it and then they adopt it, or you just never hear anything and it's a vacuum.
All right. So that was Tom Waits. Never heard anything from Tom Waits.
Never heard anything from
that
Tom
Waits. That was kind of pre-Union, though.
Pre-Union, yeah. Luxury Transistor.
Who has been, like, your biggest champion and that has received one of these?
Bob Rock has said some really nice stuff recently, especially with the compressor, which was fantastic. And even going so far as to gift them to other artists, which is unusual.
Yeah.
There's been people who like, you know, they're hard to get in touch with. It's funny, the original one that I jokingly in my head had was that I wanted to do an advert that said it will get loud after I saw it might get loud.
Yeah.
And I was like, it'd be great if we get Jack White, The Edge, and Jimmy Page. And we managed to send one to Jack White, and we managed to send one to The Edge, although there's no evidence of that anywhere, but
sure.
Jimmy Page was like the one person that nobody could seem to put us in touch with, or would if they could.
Yeah.
So we every once in a while we revise the list. It's like, who's, you know, Tad from the Hold Steady. I was kind of excited about him and Daniel Lenoir. We gave them some to check out, and he ended up buying some more, which was, that was huge. You know, it's like,
great.
Somebody that I'm trying to cop their sound is now using us as part of their sound. So that was kind of cool. We sent one to Rye Cooter, but I don't know, just disappeared.
He's a hard guy to get a hold of.
They claimed the first one arrived broken, which actually it led to this is a good story. So when we'd first developed the Moore, he was sort of one of our top people that we wanted to get one to, so we sent him one, and his management is in Vancouver, and actually it was funny. So I was out with a friend of mine. I said, "Hey, you don't know anybody that could put me in touch with Rye Cooter, do you?" He said, "No, no. Do you know who manages them?" And I was like, "That's a weird question. Why would I?
Yeah.
Why would I know who manages Rye Cooter?" And he said, "I thought you were pulling my leg. The company that I work for manages Rye Cooter."
Yeah.
I was like, "Oh. Well, no, I didn't know that at all." That's like total fluke. So he said, "Yeah, I'll put you in touch," and with his manager, not with him, obviously. So we sent him one, and they said it arrived broken. And I just went, "How do you break these? I don't understand." And so we took one and put it on the floor, and we just kind of and it broke. And I was like, "Oh shoot, that wasn't that hard at all."
Wow.
But I'm not even sure if that was what had happened, but we went through this whole process of what it was given enough force, one of the, not that people are doing this, but if you, accidentally stepped on the knob,
yeah,
it would strip out the pot. And so we took all this time. It was like, well, let's see if we can get better nuts or this or a locking washer. And we tried all these different things. And then finally we just tried two nuts. I guess, let's just try two nuts. It's like, hey, that's pretty good. It's not breaking. It's not breaking. It's like, okay, let's really put it through its paces. And we took it outside and we turned it upside down,
uh-huh,
on the cement. And I jumped on it with full force.
You're a big guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it snapped the case. Like it didn't strip out the nut, but the enclosure broke.
Yeah.
I was like, well, that's probably strong enough.
Yeah.
If it can handle that.
Yeah.
So we changed the designs where it would allow for it to that. And we sent him another one, but still didn't hear anything back.
But he changed your pedal lineup.
Yeah. He influenced it for the better without maybe even knowing it. So thanks for that.
Turns out he just spilled coffee on it or something.
Maybe. Who knows? I don't. Or maybe it was fine. Maybe they plugged it in backwards. I don't know what the deal would be. Yeah.
All right, Chris. Thanks for doing this.
Oh, thank you.
It was great to finally get the union story. I've known you for years.
Yeah. Well, there's more. We'll do another one. We'll do a follow-up one.
Well, tell me more. Is there more we should talk about?
No, right? No. I don't know. Get some coffee in me.
All right.